This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to another episode of But Why, the podcast that's all about digging into big questions and tricky topics via honest conversation. This week we're going to be looking at being selfish, and I am talking to Michelle Ellman, who is a 5-board accredited life coach, broadcaster and public speaker. She was named one of the Sun's most inspirational women in the UK. She quickly established herself as the queen of boundaries. She has a huge following and shares her experiences in all sorts of different platforms. She's written 3 books, 3, all with phenomenal titles, I might add. Am I Ugly, The Joy of Being Selfish and The Selfish Romantic. And I'm giggling to myself because I actually watched your showreel yesterday, your presenting showreel, but it's really well cut because every little snippet, I was like, oh, that's interesting, and kind of found myself wanting to watch whatever it was you were introducing. And then it moved on to the next one. I was like, oh, I was up for that. You sucked me in. But you've done a prolific body of work. Well done. It's impressive.
Thank you so much. It still feels weird when someone says 3 books because it's so new that... Yeah, it's strange. I keep joking it's like 3 before 30 because I turn 30 in August.
Wow.
It's a dream. It's really quite a dream, especially when it took, 6 years to get my first book published and 3-4 years to get my second, that it's, once the ball's rolling, it feels quite good.
And I was actually just about to ask you off mic, how long has this one been out in the world? Pretty new.
So it came out on the 5th. So the date is, so it's been out for 15 days.
And I really loved, you did a really honest bit of a snippet on Instagram about, you know, your expectations of where it would land in the bestsellers or whatever, and then just trying to remember that, not to fixate on that, which I so relate to. I actually, to be honest, the marketing of my book afterwards, I completely lost my head on. I just actually couldn't embrace it in any way. I found it really hard.
You know what? That is always the part that makes me go, I'm never doing this again. And it's so sad because I love writing. And the best part of being an author is the 8 months where no one contacts you. You don't have a single email. No one's asking for the manuscript. And you can just get lost in the words. And so every time I've had a book come out, I have hated publication day. And I just feel like that's something that's just not said enough. And publication day, I usually spend pretty much the whole day crying. And every time I resolved to try to get better at it. But the first book came out, I spent the whole day crying because it was at number 2. I mean, it sounds stupid, but I was at number 2 on the Amazon bestsellers chart. And I thought I wanted to be at number 1. I hit number 1 at 8 p.m. that evening. My second book came out. I was in the middle of the pandemic by myself. I'd been alone for 5 months. I didn't even care about the numbers at that point, even though I didn't hit any charts, not even the small Amazon chart. I didn't care. It was just more the fact that I couldn't celebrate with anyone. It wasn't in bookstores. And then the third time around, I had done this massive pre-order campaign where I personally recorded a video for every single person who pre-ordered my book, and it just set up my expectations. But no matter what the reason is, it just seems like I make myself suffer on publication day. And I was like, you know what? When I was struggling to get my first book published, and it took me 6 years, and my second one, it took me 4 years, I would see these publication day announcements and I would get jealous and I would be like, I wish I could just have a good publication day. And actually, most of my friends who are authors are like, I hate publication day too. So I was just like, you know what? I was in bed by 9 o'clock. It's not the most important day of your book being out. And the part I've always cared about, apart from the actual writing of it, is when people send me messages and I realize it's hitting real people And it's not just a bunch of numbers. And I think even in like the social media work I do, you can always get swept up in the numbers because it doesn't feel real when so much of it is online. And the thing that really brought it home and I was like, okay, now I can relax, is when I saw it in a store, which is ironically the part I completely forgot because I didn't get to do that last time because it was in a pandemic. So and the last time I was able to see my book in a store, it was in 2017. So I forgot like that. Oh, this also happens in real life too. But I just think with my whole social media presence, everyone always says social media is so fake. And I just think that's not true. You choose to be fake online. And I've always tried to not be fake online and present an image that I'm not actually living in real life.
But that's so interesting, actually. And we're going to get into boundaries. And I feel the same. I try and be myself online. But then also, then I also want to keep some of myself for myself and for my family and my friends. And it's so hard to know. I guess I try and show up as I would at work. I don't know. It's really difficult, isn't it?
No, I feel like I know what you mean when it comes to that. And where I learned it the hard way was there was definitely a point where in trying to be honest, I overshared everything. And then it was actually in the learning of boundaries that I realized, oh, there's a difference between privacy and honesty. And I don't actually have to share every aspect of my information. Like, so for example, I don't share my boyfriend online. There's no picture of him. There's no name out there. I don't share my family online. I made a joke one day in my Instagram stories that if you ask me how many siblings I have, most of my followers can't answer that question. And that's intentional, but it's not me being secretive. It's me saying, here's what you're allowed to know and here's what you're not allowed to know. And because I'm always online, it might seem like you know every aspect of my life, but there's actually huge segments you don't know. And that's not because I'm trying to be fake online, but it's more so because I believe in... So how I grew my following was around surgery scars. So it was almost like a pun, but I used to say I share my scars, not my wounds. So if something's still affecting me, I won't put it out there because I'm still vulnerable. So if I'm going through, I went through so many health issues last year and I didn't talk about most of it online because I was still really raw around it. Maybe in 2 years, maybe this year, I'll be open to talk about it. Didn't want to talk about it because I was still going through it. When I come out the other side, it might be something different. And then especially, it was more so around my relationship. I was like, I feel so protective over this person who doesn't have social media and isn't exposed to, I guess, the comments that I've got used to. And I don't want to put someone I love in that position. So, and for whatever, even the small comments on Instagram where I do mention him, I've always got these like, I don't know, just very intrusive questions. So I remember one day I like made a joke about how like I snore a lot. So I'm trying all of these techniques. And one of the techniques that I was trying was taping my mouth shut. And I got all these messages being like, your boyfriend's so abusive, the fact that he'd make you tape your mouth. And I was like, no, snoring affects me. And so I want to sleep as best as possible. He's not told me to tape my mouth, but it's even without his name, without his picture out there. People want to insert themselves in places where they're not welcome. And so I'm very strict and firm with where you are welcome and where you're not.
Oh, you've said so many kind of, privacy and honesty and scars, not wounds. That's exactly it. I will share my like self-development journey, but once I've processed it myself or at least think that I've processed it myself, because that exactly that I was in early motherhood was trying to be really honest and open and it makes you vulnerable. And also sometimes how you're reacting in the middle of a traumatic or life-changing event will be very different to how you are once you've settled with it a bit. And it's so difficult to find honesty, but honesty and privacy is a brilliant bit of language.
I also think when you are raw and you're sharing that open wound, it means when I get one of those comments, it does like rock me and it can affect my whole day. Whereas if it's a scar, then it doesn't like affect you to the same level.
That's exactly it. Where you can go, oh yeah, that's interesting. You've made a point and I can see that it's quite pokey and I can observe that, but I don't feel it. And that's exactly what you're kind of aiming for, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And also the publication day thing is so true, because the reality is anybody reading your words, or to be honest, the reality of being able to get that number of words down into a concise thing is an achievement in itself, but it's a wild journey when you're setting yourself these standards that are no good.
I think also publication day is the like closure of a very long-term project, and there are very few projects in my career, but also actually in most industries, that last like a year and a half, 2 years. So to have it all like culminate on one day makes you, it's always going to be a day full of mixed emotions. And I also think there's a certain pressure when you have, I think the reason why sometimes I get hooked up on the numbers is because there's this stereotype that if you have a following online, you get automatic bestsellers. And so I feel that pressure when actually, like, my books have always been slow burners. My books have always sold through word of mouth. And that's not a bad thing. That's because someone's read the book, loved the book, and told a friend. But that's not going to get a bestseller. And that's fine. Because I still get another book deal, and now that I'm on my third book, and I've got to the point where I'm like, what do I actually care about? One, I care that my book, you can understand the message, you can get the message, and two, that I get another book deal. That's all I care about. So if they sell enough for me to get another book deal, then that's all I care about. I always want being able to write another book as an option in my career, and that's all that matters. And there's no other industry where you'd be expected to hit the best of the industry list on your third try. Can you imagine if you were like trying to aim for the biggest awards in business in your third year of business? Like, it's just not realistic.
No, it's so true. Actually, I listened to a great podcast. I can't remember. It was, you can only write the best book that you can write with the skills. And the thing is, if you're into books and you've read the best authors, you know, literary geniuses, exactly that, like holding yourself up to people who are master craftsmen of careers that they've worked at their whole life. It's a madness.
Also, I'm not an author because I'm a literary genius by any means. Like, I'm dyslexic. Why I am an author is because I think books are so precious in that you get a prolonged period of time with a person. And from a life coach perspective, that actually is one of the mediums I think that's best to actually help create change in your life. So my goal with my book is not to get some literary award, because frankly, like, my whole school career, my whole in university, I was always told if you could write better, you'd get better grades. So like, I have under no illusions that I am not in the literary ranks at all. But for me, as a self-help author, the best self-help books is when you can clearly understand the message. And I've never understood reading a self-help book and being so caught up in the language or trying to understand a sentence that you actually can't get the lesson they're trying to teach. And so that's why I take the word easy reader as a great compliment. And what I like to say is it's hard to write an easy reader.
100% to boil these ideas down to something that people can understand and comprehend, and hopefully action. I mean, ultimately, all your books are a call to action to people to hopefully, reframe things or make purposeful changes to their life.
Absolutely. Every chapter ends with something called the Take Action Toolkit, because I'm like, okay, the book's not going to change your life unless you actually do something about it now.
Yeah, so true. So to kind of ladder back to the topic at hand, would you describe yourself as a selfish person? And I feel bad even asking that ridiculous people pleaser that I am.
Well, I think the word selfish is just, it was so interesting to me, because you would talk about self-love, you'd talk about self-care, and especially like, as of 2 years ago, it's the word that's been on everyone's lips. And then you say selfish and they're like, whoa, 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 too far. So basically, they were on board with self-love and self-care as soon as you've taken care of everyone else around you and everyone else's needs are met, which, as we both know, that means there's no time and energy left. So you'll never get around to you. And I started looking at the actual definition of selfish. And the part that I think people take issue with is that the definition ends with a disregard for other people's needs.
Okay.
But if you actually think about it, that's not optional. That's compulsory to take care of yourself. So if you want to rest on a Friday evening and your boss is sending you an email at 10 o'clock at night, you need to disregard that email and your boss's need for a reply to that email in order to have your Friday night. If your friends are inviting you out to a party on Saturday and they're telling you, oh, you're so boring because you're not coming, blah, 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 you have to disregard your friend's need for a plus one to their event so they don't have to go alone in order for you to have a quiet night on the sofa to recuperate and rebuild your energy. All of these are not optional things. When you put yourself higher on the priority list, someone automatically has to go lower.
Yeah, and it feels inherently, I think for many of us, really, really uncomfortable, doesn't it? Or it's a learned behaviour that it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, and also I think especially for women, we've been told in order to be good women, we should be selfless and we should put others first. And the women who are praised most in society are the people who are able to give the most. Actually, it's making me think of Jacinda Ardern, who resigned last night after saying that she doesn't have enough in her tank. And I think that's brave. I think that's strong. I think that speaks to a level of self-awareness and good boundaries to know your own limits. And I think for too long, because we framed men as the example of strength, we don't see the strength in more feminine qualities or traditionally feminine qualities like self-awareness, like emotional intelligence, like the fact that she's not clinging on to power for the sake of it, but can actually recognize not that someone can do the job better than her, but that someone can give more to the job than her. And that takes so much emotional intelligence. And it's things like that, which if she was selfish in, I guess, the conventional sense of the word, she would cling on to that job. And actually, she has the self-awareness to go, no, here are my limits. And it's funny because the BBC have twisted it into saying, can women have it all? And actually, my question is, do we want to have it all? Like, having it all is exhausting. I don't want to be exhausted. And with her words, she said not having not enough in her tank. Well, I don't want to live life with an empty tank.
No, it's so true. And so for me, I'm wondering whether you've had like real examples of when you haven't had these boundaries and haven't been selfish. How's that manifested for you?
So I guess the light bulb moment for me came when I was at a friend's birthday party. I was 20 years old at uni. And I was at a friend's birthday party and I was always on my phone texting my boyfriend at the time. And I left my phone in my bag and had missed his call. And when I called him back, he said, oh, that's strange. You're usually at my beck and call. And the fact that he said it to my face made me really, like, it wasn't even the fact he thought it was the fact he said it, and he said it to me, that I really just like took a moment and was like, oh, that's not great, that like that's how you think of me. And then I came home that evening, and I think it's always those moments where like everything builds up and it all happens all at once that you're a bit like, where have I got to at this point in life? I went home and all my housemates were in the middle of a fight, and somehow I walked through the door and they all turned at me, and then it was suddenly I was the problem. And someone said, do you know how much we tolerate having to live with you? And I just like went into my room with both these sentences in my head and I was like, how have I ended up in a situation with people who treat me like crap? And like, surely, like, if it was one incident, maybe, but the fact that it's my friends and my relationship, there's something I'm doing wrong that lets people not only talk to me this way, but treat me like this in general, or even think about me this way. And when it comes to boundaries, boundaries are how we teach the world to treat us. It's saying what is and isn't acceptable. And it was just a wake-up call of, there is something I am doing that is telling people that how they are treating me is acceptable when it is absolutely not.
Wow, it's often the way those horrible moments are in some part a gift, but I think it's remarkable that you had the emotional maturity to ask yourself what you were doing, whereas the quite obvious reaction is to go into this space of feeling like the victim, which you were, but you know what I mean, and blame culture. But you looked at yourself, and then what were the steps out of that moment for you?
Well, I started looking at how it came that way. And actually, if I look at it, it's that people-pleasing thing. It's the wanting to be liked, that I'd rather be liked and someone treat me badly, but them to actually be in my life than to be alone. And I had to go through a period of, I ended that relationship. I actually stopped being friends with those housemates. I moved out like 2 weeks after. And then I got the uncomfortable, had that uncomfortable period of being alone. And what's funny is when I ended that relationship, the first thing that came to mind was like relief. And I was like, okay, so if I had all of that time and energy and not channeled it into a guy who couldn't have frankly cared less about me, where could that time and energy have gone? I was in my final year of university. I was trying to write a dissertation. There were a million things I could have worked on. I was in therapy at the time because I'd just been diagnosed with PTSD from all of my surgeries. There were a million things I could have used that time and energy for in my own life to better my own life. And I had put it into a guy who, frankly, was not appreciative or thankful at all for all the things I was doing for him. And so it was a long period of being what I called consciously single. It was 3 years. I didn't go on a single date. And my thinking at the time was, I can't add someone to my life until I have my self-esteem in place, until I know what I want for my life. And at the time, my life was a mess. I was still going through the mental health crisis that came with the PTSD diagnosis. I had cut out 3 housemates out of my life who were all my best friends at the time. And actually, it was the uncomfortable thing of sitting alone and being like, well, for me to like myself, I actually have to spend time with myself. And it led to like, what, 21, 22 years old, you're meant to be out partying most of the time. And I remember sitting on my sofa like Friday night, Saturday night, being like, wow, I'm such a loser. I have no friends and I don't have a relationship anymore. But looking back, that's what formed my self-esteem again. It was actually learning how to enjoy spending time with myself. And I think sometimes we think it works the other way, that like when you love yourself, you'll spend time with yourself. But actually forcing myself to spend time alone and be okay in my own company is what taught me to like myself and then eventually love myself.
I think that's so interesting, actually, because when you're talking about the examples you gave of showing selfishness is not going to that party, not replying to that email. And actually, so often we fill our lives with stuff. And I do wonder sometimes whether we're doing it just to avoid being alone with ourselves, with our thoughts and with our own self-worth.
Well, that's what you realize when you start spending alone time, is that, oh, the reason why I had 30 best friends, which is not normal or usual or sustainable in any way, is because I was so scared of being alone. Because when you're alone, you've got that silence, which means you hear your thoughts and you can feel your feelings, which were all the things I was avoiding, especially because of my PTSD. And so when you have that alone time, you're forced to not just hear your inner thoughts, but sit in those feelings and realize, yes, they're uncomfortable. Yes, it's painful. But, you know, not feeling it was actually having a worse consequence on my life.
Yeah, that's it. The elaborate means of avoiding feeling stuff, it becomes the problems, doesn't it? Through whether that's, you know, top of my head, alcohol or exercise or shopping or, yeah, dating. It's a space where addiction tends to form, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And you're just trying to numb your feelings and avoid what will surface at some point. And I think one of the things that helps me every time I don't want to feel my feelings now is I think now or later at a more inconvenient time. And that's essentially what my PTSD was, it was a decade after I'd had my surgeries, because I was like, not now, too busy, can't do this, like, can't feel it right now, I'll do it one day. Well, one day came in the middle of like me trying to finish my dissertation. Worst timing, but it will come at the worst timing if you don't create time for it. When it's slightly inconvenient, it will come when it's even more inconvenient.
I agree. I don't drink, because I say that for me, alcohol became like wearing Spanx. Like, you're feeling anxious, so you have a gin and tonic, and then you put on, you know, the emotional equivalent of Spanx, and then that stuff just spills out somewhere else. You can't rearrange your feelings like you can't rearrange your body. It's like, yeah, it always is going to make an appearance. And you're so right. If you don't allow yourself to feel it, then it's always the worst time. And you end up with these monumental moments when suddenly it feels like everything's crumbling. But it's the nature of massive avoidance, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think when I actually did create time to feel it, it was like a year of pretty much crying every day. And it's funny, I always think it's funny when a life coach says that, because you always have this perception that psychologists, life coaches have a somewhat perfect life. But I think it's so important to show that actually, I believe the best people who work in personal development are doing the work too. And if I'd been given permission to feel while I was 11 years old in hospital, it wouldn't have come crashing down at 21.
No. And I was interested to know how like your health as a child had woven into this, and it's beginning to become very apparent. Had you been aware that you should mask your feelings, or and it was something that was imposed on you, or was it just a natural reaction?
So I think when you are a child in hospital, you become acutely aware of all the emotions in the room, or at least I did. And you know that if you start crying, your parents are going to get even more scared. Everyone around you gets worried. Like when I started crying, the nurses would get worried because that's you losing potassium and it's stress on your body when you cry. So there was a lot of trying to not let me cry. And I was 11 years old. So I remember also, anytime I got angry, being told like, you have the best care in the world, you're so lucky, like all of these things. I remember when they found my brain tumor, they said to me, how they found my brain tumor was they made a mistake, punctured my intestines, and I, as a result, had to stay in hospital for an extra 2 months. When they were doing the scan, they found my brain tumor. And so somehow it got twisted into, you're so lucky and so grateful that they punctured your intestines, because otherwise they wouldn't have found the brain tumor. So everything got twisted into a very like optimistic view. And actually my first book I started writing when I was 12 years old. And if you go back to the first draft of that first book, every single page had the word luckily in it, which I think just shows how much I was told like, you're not allowed to be angry, you're not allowed to be sad. And I remember feeling things like all of my friends, after you did exams in the first year, you got to like basically have this really fun period of time where you do like really fun projects. And I remember being in hospital, being really sad and angry that I wasn't with my friends because the doctor had screwed up, but not being allowed to feel that anger because every time I did, I was told to quiet and down, you're disturbing other people on the ward, all of these things. And I think if someone had just said, you know what, if I just found out I had a brain tumor, I'd be a bit pissed off too. Like someone said that to me, I could have actually felt it at the time. But I think that's where the people pleaser was born. There was so much of me that wanted to caretake the people in the room that like, I didn't want my parents getting more worried. I didn't want my parents getting more upset. So I just pushed down my feelings. And I think there's also a lot of pressure on children in hospital to be brave, to be a survivor, because there's so much mentality around, if you have a positive outlook, you'll have a positive outcome around your health. And so you need to keep positive. But actually, I think what would have been better if someone had just said, you know what, you can cry, you can be angry, and we will figure out the medical side of it. But actually, you don't need to have a smile on your face in order to survive this.
Yeah. And also, let's be real, you're going into puberty. So you've got a whole load of that going on as well. So like, we all have all that anger as a teen, and someone just needs to allow you to actually explain that to you. The reason you feel a bit rocky is also, yeah, these hormones. And I'm wondering, you're in this difficult thing at that age where your body is being handed over to science and people are needing to do what they need to do to you. And it's like, how much were you given information about what was going on, and how much were you hearing it secondhand?
So a lot wasn't told to me. Like I was under a lot of drugs, like just because of the infection and everything. But I remember I wasn't told about the brain tumor when they found out about the brain tumor, because they thought I was quite depressed. So they wouldn't. And actually, talking about the anger piece, they did actually send a psychologist to me because I was so angry. And she diagnosed me, like I've seen the form since, with temper tantrums as an actual diagnosis, with the accompanying medication of antidepressants as the cure. And I just look at it and I'm like, and also she was a trainee, which I just think you shouldn't be sending a trainee to an 11-year-old's room. But when I looked at that form, I was like, it's so funny how no one has actually thought about the situational side effects to this. Like, sorry, tell an adult that they just had a brain tumor after being in hospital for 3 months because of a doctor's mistake. And what, that's normal to be angry because someone else has made a mistake and you're in pain as a result of it. I don't think the normal side effect is like, oh, thank God you found my brain tumor. That's, by the way, been in my body for 11 years and you've missed for 11 years. And so, yeah, it's this, I don't know. It's just, it was a lot of, when you label something, a genuine anger, legitimate anger, as temper tantrums, it's also quite invalidating. So I think it was just like a mess of all of that.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
What a lot to unpick. It is no wonder that you had long-term mental challenges around it, because it's just, it's such a crucial point in your life for your messaging around things. I'm really aware with my kids, where I'm like, you can feel whatever you feel. What we do need to work on is how you react. So you feel angry that your brother's got something that you want. And we all feel envy, but what isn't okay is to punch him because of it. And that's a generational shift, I guess, to be able to allow those feelings to happen. But yours is on the kind of most dialed up version of that.
Yeah, and I think that's also the other part, is like, it's hard to know how to deal with a situation like that when it's, like, I couldn't talk to my friends about it because it's somewhat of an adult problem to have brain tumor. I mean, it sounds silly because obviously children get brain tumors, but like, all of it was very adult language. So then to go to my 11-year-old peers in school and be like, here's what I just went to. Like, no one asked me what I went through. No one talked to me about my surgeries. I couldn't talk to my best friends about it because it was just an unrelatable problem.
Wow, that's huge. And I guess I'm thinking of your parents, and they're obviously out, they are trying to deal with their own feelings. And I guess that would have, it's an impossible situation. I cannot believe that. I didn't know that was the story, that they found your tumour by accident.
It is. It's one of those, I mean, when I got my first book deal, people would be like, how are you writing a memoir at 24? Are you either really famous or has something happened to you? And that's the question people used to ask. And I was like, the latter. But I was like, yeah, 15 surgeries before the age of 19 is not exactly normal.
I actually watched a bit of an interview you did with Katie Piper, and about how in the pandemic it was kind of refreshing for you to see lots of people understand what health anxiety is like and how that can end up shaping everything. And again, that must be a huge thing for you to have worked to find a place in your life for that.
Well, also what was strange is I'd actually been through a pandemic before. I was in Hong Kong for SARS. So I went through that when I was in year five in school, and I missed the whole year five. And then we went back to school in year six as if nothing had happened. So when the pandemic hit here, I was very much like, well, people were asking me, how are you so okay? I was like, I've done this before. Like, but not just, I've done the medical worry side, I've done the health cautiousness side, but I've done the actual pandemic side of not being allowed to see my friends and having to stay home and all of these things. But obviously I also had the part of my brain was like, oh, this is going to last max a year, we'll get over it. And obviously this one lasts a bit longer. So I wasn't quite prepared. Once we hit, like, I think it was the second lockdown, I was like, I can't do this anymore, because I was like, I've done my bandwidth of repeating essentially the length of SARS. But yeah, that's when I had my like own spiral. But I think what people don't understand around chronic illness is it takes up so much of your brain power. It takes up so much of your time and energy. The admin of booking doctor's appointments, having your checkups, all of these things, making sure your medication is all on top of. And also it limits your life in a way that you're always thinking about what you can't do before what you can do. And it took a lot of, it actually took this body positive aspect of my work to really change my mindset around it, because I was like, I'm always focusing on what I can't do because of my body, when actually there aren't many people in the world who go through my medical history and, number one, survive, and number two, are so able that day-to-day life you wouldn't even know. Like, I still can do whatever I want, I can still go paddleboarding, I can still, all the things, I'm a quite an active person, like I love doing things, like I went kayaking on the Thames last year, like 12 kilometers. I never even picked up a like oar before, and then decided, you know what, let's go. All of these things are actually things that put me in the category of really quite able for my medical history. And because I was so angry about everything, part of that anger turned inwards around my body, and I was angry at my body for not surviving, having all of these issues that, like, I think I say within my TED talk, I had more organs wrong. There were more organs that had something wrong with it than not. And so it's really hard to then not look at your friends and go, and it, I guess there would have been two ways to do it. Look at my friends and be like, I'm so jealous, you don't have to worry about this. But I went the other way of like, why can't I be like you? There's something wrong with me. And I think that turned into a lot of hatred for my body, especially, as you said, around puberty, was actually about the physical appearance. Like, I have scars all over my stomach. How the hell do I deal with this conversation? Changing in a changing room for PE, it brought up insecurities that I just didn't want to have to think about or talk about. And since I couldn't talk about my surgeries, good luck trying to talk about my surgery scars, because that just led back to that first conversation.
Yeah, you've got nowhere to hide from it then. And yeah, and a bit like we were talking about before, they were scars, but they were pretty fresh scars, weren't they? So it's that trying to, you haven't processed it yourself, and then you're suddenly, and also, let's be real, you're a child, so you haven't got the emotional intelligence or even the language, and neither have your peers. You know, now someone might actually say, oh, you know, how are you? what's this experience been like? But of course they didn't know how, did they?
The funny thing is, when my memoir came out, so many of my school friends, some I wasn't even in touch with anymore, reached out and was like, I had no clue what you went through back then. No one talked about it. None of the teachers talked about it. And the one person who was, the one friend who was actually really good at talking about it and was really there for me, was, flew out to Hong Kong even when I came out of hospital to like meet me. She even sent me a message and was like, and I hadn't spoken to her in maybe like 10 years. And she sent me a message and just was like, I've just read your book. I know it's like 3 years too late, but I just want to say I'm sorry I wasn't there for you more. And I replied being like, did you read the same book as me? Because the whole book was basically saying you were the only person I could talk to about my surgeries. And I think it's that thing around, like, when you are ashamed of something, you want to stay quiet about it. You want silence around it. And that actually helps breed the shame. And so once I started talking about it, I actually realized that I got okay with the surgery scars once I could actually have a conversation about the surgeries. But until that point, looking in a mirror was a reminder of the worst time in my life. Whereas if I actually could say, oh no, I got these surgery scars from these surgeries, and talk about my surgeries, then they didn't hold the same power over me.
That's so interesting. It's so interesting. And I mean, what an amazing bit of, not closure, but to be able to put that book out in the world and to have people reach out. Not that it solves it, but you've helped put a bit of the piece of the puzzle together there, haven't you?
Well, I think also in the writing of it, I wrote it at, I was very much trying to, so at 11 years old, trying to write from the mentality of an 11-year-old and actually understanding all of it, because by the time it was published, I was 24. Understanding all of it in the context of the age that I was at the time, I was like, you know what, the fact that I screamed at a psychologist at 11 years old, I forgive 11-year-old me. She was doing the best she could. And actually seeing every event that took place in my life in the context of that age, and actually imagining another 11-year-old going through it and how I would feel if it was another 11-year-old, I was able to heal a lot of it myself, going, wow, I've been so hard on myself. I was 11 years old.
It's so funny you should say this. I did a lot of EMDR therapy two years ago around some stuff from when I was a kid. And all the way through, I was doing the work. And then weirdly, my mum sent some photos of the exact chapter that I was doing the therapy about. And I saw a photo of myself, and I could just for the first time, seeing myself as the child that I was, not the how mature I felt in my head for my age. And I was just like, you were a kid, an actual kid. Look at you with your 80s outfit on. And you're so right. You have to go back and see the child that you were.
I remember I saw a quote once on Instagram that I've never forgotten, which was like, a lot of times when you go through things like that, someone will go like, well, that's what made you strong. And it was a quote saying, I didn't need to be strong, I needed to be safe. And actually that's like, if it still makes me cry thinking about it now, but like, it's true, I just needed to be safe. I needed to know I was going to be okay.
Yeah, you needed to be able to be a child, which is essentially what childhood is that the adults in the room are looking out for you, which, don't get me wrong, they definitely were looking out for you. They were trying to get you healthy, but it's keeping an eye on your emotional self, I suppose, as well.
Exactly. And as you said, it's a generational thing. They didn't know how to handle it at the time. But I think now there's a bigger conversation about how there's no feelings are wrong, no emotions are wrong. How you react to them might be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to jump forward now to where you're at now, because I was really not enjoying, because I think that sounds quite mean, but I was fascinated in your dating journey. And then lo and behold, you meet a boy. And yes, we're not going to give too much about him, but it must have been an interesting experience having, you know, delved into living a joyful, selfish life. And then you meet a boy, and then I guess it's what's led to your next book. So talk to me about this chapter and where you're at now.
So what was ironic about this book deal is I got it 2 weeks before. So I wasn't in a relationship. This was pitched as a single girl's guide to dating. I wanted to write a book as a single woman because there's nothing worse, which now I'm that person, than being preached to by someone in a relationship who has never dated, or someone who's been in a marriage for 10 years and like is preaching to you about how you should date. And it's like, well, the last time you dated, there's no such thing as a dating app. There was no, like, you wouldn't even have known the word ghosting. So you're trying to teach me about something that is completely different landscape. The irony is I got the book deal 2 weeks later. My now boyfriend asked me to be his girlfriend. And I was like, went back to my editor and was like, really sorry, but like, there's a funny thing about life. It sort of happens when you least expect it. And I can't write this book as a single woman. It's still going to be about my 8 years of dating, but it might just have a slightly different ending. So the last chapter of the book is about my relationship and how all the lessons in the book are how I ended up in this relationship. Like, I preach how much I love dating apps. I met my partner on a dating app. I talk about how you shouldn't rush things. Me and my partner weren't official until 6 months into the relationship. I talk about how you can date multiple people at the same time. We had to have separate conversations about when we're exclusive and when we're in a relationship. All of these things don't prove that the thing that my book works. But what proves that the book works is that I had the most wonderful 8 years of being single. And I don't think there are many people who talk about their single period with such positivity.
And also, the crux of any relationship, and I say this however many years married, and marriage isn't easy, but you have to constantly be choosing it, and it has to be two people on two journeys, and you choose for those journeys to coexist. And I think that is, if you've really, really delved into self-worth and living in a way that is honors you, it means you're choosing to let him be by your side. You're not needing him, and you're not, I think.
And I think that's where this lesson of being alone is better than a bad relationship meant it not only raised my standards, but I was like, I can take care of my needs. I'm no longer, when you don't have self-esteem, you look to everyone else to validate you, fill up your bucket, and meet your needs. But I always now look at it from that single perspective of, okay, but are you actually doing for yourself what you're asking everyone else to do? And are you asking for things that you don't even expect from yourself? So if you cannot say that you can do that for yourself, if you're not that kind of person, then you can't expect that from other people. That's unrealistic. And it's also unfair.
Yeah, it's so true. How has he dealt with all the work that you've done? Has he kind of been on this journey with you?
I think he very much met me when I'd learned all of the lessons I kind of needed to learn. So when I talk about past experiences, which obviously he overhears as part of my job, of like my ex-boyfriend talking to me the way he did, he's kind of shocked because he's like, that's not the person I know. And I quite like that he thinks that, where it's like, I'm so different to that person. And I don't think we would have, being frank, I don't actually think we would have ended up together if I was that person. Because if I think about the initial dating period, there were moments where I was, for lack of a better word, a difficult person, because I actually think how you should date is show who you are, all aspects of yourself, and not put on this best first impressions and try to appear more easygoing and more low maintenance than you are. I am a difficult person, but I believe that is everyone in the world. I think everyone's difficult to date, but I don't want to trap someone in a relationship and then 2 months into the relationship drop that mask and be like, okay, but this is actually what I want, and I've just been pretending to be easygoing and low maintenance. So there was a day when he said he would let me know about a date, and he never did. And so I was like, great. I had probably been on dating apps a bit too long. I had just been used to people ghosting me. I thought he was ghosting me. And then 2 days later, I get this text being like, hey, how was your weekend? And I was like, oh, so you're not ghosting me. Well, in that case, don't appreciate the lack of communication either way. And I was on the way to the theater with my friends. And usually before, I would have reorganized my life, been late for my friends, all of these things, to have that conversation, sat at home texting. And I just said, I don't have time for this. If you want to resolve this, pick up the phone and call me. Otherwise, I'm leaving the house in 20 minutes. And he picked up the phone and called me, which actually shocked me at the time, because I don't think there's a single person up to that point who I'd had a phone conversation with. And he picked up the phone and was like, I'm so sorry. I think there was a miscommunication. I didn't think we'd settled on a date. And I was like, you can go back over our text, because we did. And I said something like, I don't like talking about how busy I am, but for me to give someone a Saturday is a really big deal. And for me to have a Saturday wasted is an even bigger deal. And I don't like my time being wasted, and I'm not going to put up with it for a second time. I didn't say it in a nicer way. I didn't say it in a way where it could be accepted more easily. Frankly, I didn't say it in a way considering his feelings at all. I said it in a way that I would say it to a friend. That's true. I hate my time being wasted. If a friend leaves me waiting for an hour outside a restaurant, which one of my friends has done, I would just as bluntly say to them, excuse me, your time is not more important than mine. And so it was that thing of, when you're dating, a lot of the times you almost try to appear better than you would if you were communicating to your best friend who you've known for 10 years. And I just wasn't at that stage in my life. I was like, look, if you think how I'm talking to you right now, I wasn't being rude. I was just being direct. And I was being very clear with my communication of what I expect. And if that's too much for you on what I think it must have been a fourth date, then fine. Good riddance. Goodbye. Like, but I'm going to set out what I expect. And I don't think being communicated with is a high expectation.
Yeah, so true. I remember as a teen in my 20s, like, oh, you know, you've got to be the cool, easy breezy, low maintenance girl. It's like, no, I don't need to be difficult, but I do need, I'm okay, A, to be a complex person, and I can't change that, and B, to, yeah, be communicated with and have boundaries and have my time respected. But yeah, there's definitely that narrative of you just got to be cool. It does matter a lot.
It's that narrative of you don't want to be like other girls. So like you're the one who can chill with the boys. And it's really sexist. And it was all fed by the media, because there was definitely a point where every rom-com was with that chilled, easy breezy girl. And I was like, I've never been that person. And when I say I'm difficult, I truly believe everyone's difficult. I might be difficult because I expect you to respect my time. I'm not going to reply to a 2 a.m. text. I'm not going to say yes when you've asked me out with less than 24 hours notice. But on the other hand, I'm emotionally intelligent. I can communicate. I can apologize when I do something wrong. All of these are skills that are hard to learn. And I know, because I had to learn them the hard way. Mm. But there are aspects of me that make me difficult, because I do have high standards for the people in my life. But there's also an aspect of me where it's a lot easier to resolve any conflicts, because I've worked on myself and I can have these communications because I can communicate how I feel. And if you're dating someone who is that easygoing, low maintenance, maybe they truly don't care if you leave them waiting for an hour. You don't know, they could be difficult in another aspect. And an example I use in the book is There was a TV show I was watching and they were talking about how stingy her partner was. And I was like, oh, that's actually an issue I've never had to deal with. And you don't think about the ways in which you're easy, where I'm quite easy around, like, I'm quite generous with money. I don't really think about, like, I don't count things, and I definitely wouldn't try to control what another partner is spending, because that, to me, that's none of my business. But I've never thought about that, because it's just, you always focus on what makes you difficult. And one of the narratives that was always told to me is like, oh, you're always going to struggle to find someone to date because I'm a very emotional, sensitive person. I probably cry like 2 to 3 times a week. Like, I feel everything very deeply. But in some ways, I'm a very easy person to date. And I think we need to be able to look at ourselves from the big picture lens of, okay, in these ways I'm difficult, but also in these ways I'm actually quite easy.
Well, yeah. And also, the fact is, if you're feeling the feelings, and I'm the same, feeling the feelings all the time, at least they're there and they're out, and it's like things aren't festering. You're getting exactly what I'm showing up with right here. And the whole point of boundaries is, once you have them, the putting them in might feel difficult, but the living with them is very easy. I don't want anyone at my house after 10 p.m. because I like to go to bed early. That makes me sound difficult, but now it's very easy because, you know, yeah, when you're coming to my house, leave at 9:59 and we're all good. That's it.
Well, this is the flip side of the word difficult, which is why I just, like, don't let it be weaponized against me anymore, is that actually all the times I've been called difficult for setting boundaries are only by people, first of all, who don't like my boundaries, who are frankly getting tired of the fact that I am making their life more inconvenient, but it's not my job to make their life more convenient. And then usually the other set of people who react badly to your boundaries are people who don't have their own boundaries. But I think the reason why, when someone's calling you difficult, and it's all these words, difficult, high maintenance, harsh, rude, aggressive, and it's usually only women who are being called these names for setting boundaries, selfish for setting boundaries, is actually the end result is those people leave your life. And I had a lot of people leave my life because I suddenly started setting boundaries. But the people who stay, you end up having a very simple life because you say what you mean and you mean what you say, and there's no... There was so much of my 20s wasted thinking about things like, oh, are my friends angry at me? Oh, did she mean something by that comment? And actually, all of that disappears when you say what you mean and you mean what you say, because no friend now has to second guess whether I'm angry at them. Because if I'm angry at them, I will literally say the words, hey, by the way, I'm really angry at you at the moment. And it doesn't mean I say it with anger. I just say it like that, like casually, like, hey, by the way, I'm really angry at you. And then usually people will ask why, and I'll tell them why.
And then it's resolved. Like, and that, yeah. And then a thing doesn't become a thing. A friend said something in a text the other day, and I misread it, to be honest, but I, again, flagged it. I was like, that's a bit harsh. And she'd just, again, I couldn't get her intonation. She had meant something totally different. And I'm so glad I had the confidence now to say, that's a bit harsh, that's hurt, because she wasn't meaning it. And that could have sat with me and become a thing that wasn't a thing so easily.
Yeah, absolutely. There's in The Joy of Being Selfish, I use the word ouch a lot. So if someone says something mean, I just now go, ouch, that hurt. Like, it turns out you don't have to. What I didn't understand when I didn't have boundaries is, by setting boundaries, you don't actually have to have a massive argument every time you set a boundary. You can just acknowledge when someone is saying something disrespectful of like, please don't speak to me like that. Moving on, like, whether they apologize or not, I've set down my boundary. And I'll show you, I'm not going to just stand here while you speak to me that way. Or if someone raises their voice at me, I can walk out the room and say, come and find me when you're ready to speak to me in a more respectful way. Like, all of these things, I'm not engaging in this drama anymore. And the problem is, when you can't communicate like you did with your friend, you communicated it directly. What usually happens is, because especially women have been trained to be indirect communicators, because we've not been given the permission to be direct, is you go to your other friend and you go, you never guess what blah and blah just said to me. And then it becomes this really complicated problem, because someone feels like they have to take sides. And it's actually like, well, if you could communicate with the person you have an issue with, you're also communicating with the person who can resolve the issue.
Yeah, it's so true. And you're also so right about the male female thing. You see boys do it all the time. Or, don't be an idiot. And literally, yeah, thump on the arm, done. It's like, you have quite literally said, that's my line, don't cross it, we put it in, we move on. And yeah, women do that. We haven't been direct with each other and we spiral something into a drama. And we're missing a trick because you're actually damaging relationships that could be great just because someone can't mind read.
The reason why women do it is because we've been penalized for being direct by these words. Like, if a woman is direct in the workplace, they get called like awful names from the B word to like, I don't know whether I'm allowed to swear, but all of these names because, how many bosses get called bitches because they are direct with their communication in the same way a man is? But then when a man does it, oh, well, they're direct, they're outspoken, they know what they want. And when a woman does it, oh, she's really difficult. She has an iron fist, all of these words that so as a result, it's no wonder women have learned to communicate indirectly to get what they want.
Yeah. And you're right, it ends up being so much time wasted on grey areas and overthinking and, yeah, issues that aren't issues. And none of us have got time for that. So I always end on a couple of questions. Number one, where can people find you and what do you want to shout about?
So I'll shout about my new book, The Selfish Romantic, How to Date Without Feeling Bad About Yourself. You can find me on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, all the places, at Michelle L. Ellman. And yeah, that's about it. Oh, and I have a podcast called In All Honesty.
Again, without meaning to suck up to you, but I think you've got your ducks in a row. I went through your social and like your website and everything felt like it was well linked. So whatever you've been doing with your time or whoever you've got doing that for you, you've done it very well. Oh, this is what I mean
to
do. Good.
I'm so glad to know that. I've done it all myself and I haven't touched it in years. So I'm glad you can find my showreel, you can find my website, All of those things.
It was very comprehensive and I like comprehensive. That's exactly what you want. I want to find this information. It's available to me. And my last question is, if you could have an honest conversation with one person, who would it be and what would you say?
Ooh, I always think you can have an honest conversation with your parents. I think that resolves quite a lot. I feel like it's probably the area in my life I still struggle to set boundaries. And I think it's because... your family relationships are your longest relationships. And so they know the old you. And sometimes it's very hard for them to come out from under that and see who you are now and recognize that you're not actually the same person you were when you were like 15 years old and treat you as the, 29-year-old I am now.
Oh, that's so juicy. And yeah, you're right. It's always that's the hardest chat, but it's the same with anyone who's known you a long time, that it doesn't necessarily allow for the growth. And it's not to say that the old you hasn't informed the new you, but if you've intentionally tried to grow and change and work hard, it's very difficult to be pulled back to a version of you that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think most people regress around their parents as well.
Awful, awful. So what I always see this journey of like 24 hours together, it's really nice and it all works. And then, yeah, like... 2 to 3 days. It's like, what are we doing? You've got to.
There's a tipping point.
Get out. But everybody does it, don't they? It's really hard to move beyond that. Thank you so much for a really, really fascinating chat. You've done a lot of light bulb moments for me. And I think it's brilliant. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been lovely.
Oh, well, that was a fascinating conversation. I mean, I definitely feel slightly out of touch because. As Michelle mentioned in an offhand comment, when I was last dating, it was before the internet. Not the internet. The internet existed, but dating apps didn't. So I don't fully comprehend the boundaries that would be required to do that. But I do think that boundaries and knowing when your limits are and what you can give people, because I didn't get around to talking to Michelle about it, but for me, parenting has been one huge act of selflessness, and that might be very at odds with the conversation that we had. And I actually get a lot from that. I've learned a lot by being able to put other people at the very, very top of my pile. But I think the important thing, and maybe a generational shift, is that I don't put so much of myself. I don't put them so far up the pecking order that I totally lose myself. And I think that is the important thing. It's about knowing what your limits, what you can give, and without it becoming a place of resentment or doing it for the wrong reasons. But a very interesting chat and, yeah, utterly mind-blowing about her medical history. I have a lot of respect for her journey in processing that. And thank you guys for being here. That's another episode of But Why Done. Always, always, always grateful to have you. Be very grateful if you came over and followed us on Instagram at But Why Podcast. I am now off to eat some chocolate. I'm currently on about half a bar a day of the Lindt 70% stuff. So just going to keep going with that. Wishing you a lovely day and see you next time. Bye-bye.